So I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight, and my family and friends for all your support, and to everybody at Alcoholics Anonymous for showing me that I absolutely cannot put a drink in my body. It makes me sick. And also that I am a prescription drug addict. It also makes me very sick. To all the people in the Catholic Church who have helped me along this path of a 30-year conversion. When I was a little girl, I always wanted to be a waitress, a teacher, and the president. And so in the spirit of serving and teaching big, I'd like to hand out a handout for you to look at as I'm talking here. This is just my story and how I worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like to be mindful of Tradition 10, in which AA has no outside opinion, any opinions on outside issues, that this is simply my story, my experience of how I worked the 12 steps, how God, as I understand him, if I use the name Jesus, that is how God has revealed himself to me through my story. A couple of weeks ago, on the feast day of the Nativity of St. John the Baptist, I went up to St. Peter's in Ashton, Wisconsin, and went to a exposition of saint reliquaries. And it was very interesting because it was a PowerPoint presentation on all these different saints, and the presenter said, "You'll know which saint is yours, either by when you touch the reliquary, it will feel warm or hot, or when you go near it, you'll smell roses, or you'll just get this intuitive sense that you'll be kind of drawn towards a certain saint." And there was a tables of 100 different saints. And so I went around to each one, and I found my saint right away. And when I touched the reliquary, it was warm. Actually, it was hot. It was St. John the Baptist. And a Franciscan in Albany, Wisconsin, Father Isaac, told me that St. John the Baptist signifies healing. And so that was my saint. I found him right away. So there's some kind of significance with me and healing. And so if you look at the very front of the handout, you know, this is a really interesting time for me to be talking just about my story and, you know, getting over a life-threatening addiction and, you know, the end of a 30-year conversion. It's the year of faith. And Pope Benedict XVI calls the year of faith from October 11th, 2012 through November 24th of 2013. And so it's July 24th of 2013. So we're right smack dab in the middle of that. In the history of the last 200 years, we're right here. And the Year of Faith aims at rediscovering how much God loves us and how we're preparing to respond to that love. And in the Catholic Church, they call conversion a drawing closer to Jesus and a means of changing directions. In our house, when we're teaching our little kids, you know, developing their consciences, we tell them, you know, you can go down the happy trail or the crappy trail. Well, we definitely want to turn away from the crappy trail and start heading up the happy trail, and that's exactly what happened. And I've been striving and seeking and knocking all these years, and finally, with Alcoholics Anonymous at the very end, was able to make it over to the other side safely. And so drawing very close to Jesus. And so once again, this is a story of how I worked the 12 steps of AA and how I was cured of a life-threatening drug addiction, but also a conversion story, 30 years in the making. Just a quick little bit about me. I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm an only child. Both sides of my family are Catholic. My dad's parents were married by my dad's uncle, who was a Jesuit priest. So that kind of is in my family, that real religious side of the family. And then on my mom's side of the family, they were also Catholic. My father was an alcoholic, and my mother was or is a drinker. If you look on the second page, I included a picture of my first communion, and the reason I did that was because if I was to sum up one single day out of my whole early childhood, from the dawn of reason until 9 years old, I would say that this would probably sum it up. It was joyful, it was peaceful, it was calm, it was loving, it was happiness, and it was joy. There was no drama. It was just a very simple childhood, and I was very happy. And then a couple years later, at the age of 9, we moved into this community over here called Orchard Ridge, which is kind of off of Raymond Road, Verona Road area. And I started a new school, and I naturally became the leader of all my friends. This is when bad things started to happen. My dad became very, very sick with alcoholism, and I remember him driving into our driveway without a car door on the side of his car, and really not understanding how to process that, and also seeing him drive in to the car, showing me pictures of being in a car accident where a guardrail was going through his windshield, and he told me that if he had his seatbelt on, he would have been pierced in the heart. So not really knowing what to do with a lot of really scary things that were happening to me. It was very sad, very scary. I was very angry. There was a lot of abandonment and a lot of neglect. And it was very different from this, you know, first communion picture, ideal life that was only just 2 years before that. And so also during this time, like roughly from the ages of between 9 and 13, because the family was sick, my father was sick with alcoholism severely, and it made the family sick, and I was an only child, there was really no instruction in the development of conscience in terms of, like, you know, love of neighbor, love of God, honor your parents, no lying, no stealing. It just was absent. I was just kind of forgotten. In a sense. And so I recently did a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder work with Gateway, with my counselor at Gateway, and she asked me, was there anything that made you feel safe when you were a child? Was there anything anywhere? And I said, yes, my dad's parents' house, these very, very holy, faithful people on West Shore Drive in Madison. And she said, well, what was it about being there that made you feel so safe? And I said, well, they had a picture on the wall. And the picture that they had on the wall was this picture. This is the picture that I used to stare at and gaze at as a child. And whenever I used to look at that, this is called the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And it was a devotion that was popular around the World War II era. And I remember just always feeling safe and okay looking at that picture, even though everything in my home life was a wreck and being destroyed around me and not really understanding it. And the reason why I wanted to show you this was because I did include a picture of the Sacred Heart in the packet. Our Lord Jesus Christ made these 12 promises to those who honor his Sacred Heart to St. Margaret Mary Alacoque, a French nun, in the 1670s. So this was that devotion that was popular among World War II. And there's a set of promises that go along with this devotion, and I included it in the packet because they seem to be happening to me right now in present, in real time. Number 7, fervent souls shall mount to high perfection. Number 11, those who promote this devotion shall have their names written in my heart, never to be effaced. There's lots of peace to their homes, comfort in all their sufferings. There's lots of things, just like in AA, there's promises. There's also a set of promises with the Sacred Heart, which is interesting because that's what held me together as a child. That was my connection to God in my PTSD work. And so at age 13, I took my first drug, which was marijuana, and then I started drinking from there. I was just surviving. I was drinking to medicate. I was skipping school. I had troubles with the law. I was angry, depressed, and sad. And I thought, if I could just get out of Orchard Ridge, I would just be fine. And I did. I went off to college, and I joined a sorority, which was a drinking sorority, which is probably not a good idea for an alcoholic, but it was undetected at that time because I was very good at hiding also. And I was an only child, and I was isolated, so nobody really caught on, and an adult anyway. I got a degree in biology, and it was of not really any interest to me. However, it allowed me to get a job in a real high-profile job as a drug rep in a drug company. And I was extremely successful in that position. I took it all the way to the top, to President's Honor Club, the pinnacle. But at the top of that, there was nothing. It was just a big zero. It was empty. All the cars and the money and the trips and all of that, just the hole was inside of me. And so all of that stuff, just I knew that I needed to do something different. And it just, like in the big book says, I mean, I just, that was self-will run riot that whole time until I got to that pinnacle. And, you know, my addiction was responsible for a failed marriage. You know, I had it annulled. I always tried to be obedient to the church. You know, another failed marriage. I waited 5 years. I always had this sense that I wanted a family just because I came from a family that was sick. From alcoholism, an abortion, a failed engagement. You know, my addiction tried to take away this marriage and my kids. And it was in 2003, 10 years ago, in the, which is kind of when my real conversion or turning towards Jesus started, when my father drowned in a swimming pool. So everything is like in threes. In 83, I took my first drug. In 2003, 20 years later, my father drowns. And then 10 years later, I'm right here. So it's all in the year of faith. It's very systematical and makes a lot of sense. So that was the day when my heart was ripped out of my chest. When I found my father drown from alcoholism and addiction at age 56 in a swimming pool. And because I am an only child and my mother has always been independent and trying to survive herself, I only knew to go to the church. And so I tease my husband and say that his in-laws are the Catholic Church, whether he likes it or not. But I went to St. Andrew's in Verona. Well, actually, Father Poster went to boys' school with my father in St. Ray's and then Edgewood. And he actually did my father's funeral up here at St. Maria Goretti. And so I fell into his hands, first of all. And I just recently saw him in Baraboo a couple weeks ago and told him that he's a part of my story now. And then I went to live with my mother and in Verona, which was just a few blocks away from St. Andrews. And so I took refuge there to get help for myself. At that point, I quit. I wasn't really drinking. I was taking prescription drugs more or less to help me, but I was abusing those. I wasn't taking them correctly. I was trying to manipulate the doctors to give me more Valium, and my addiction wasn't going to let go of that Valium. And so I remember having one sense of humility there when I was on all these medications saying, you know, why would you take my father? I was actually acknowledging God saying why, and then I remember saying, give me a purpose. And then it was shortly after that that I met my husband. I guess, how did I'll kind of launch into into a talk. My sponsor recently asked me to speak at the Seven Deadly Sins Conference, and I was extremely humbled by that offer because it was on pride. And, you know, how did I even end up in AA or getting into recovery, because my addiction was so masked and enfolded in different things. It's hard to know, but pride, Wikipedia states, is an inflated sense of one's personal status or accomplishments, and St. Augustine calls it the love of one's own excellence. For me, pride is believing something about myself that isn't true, or that I know better than me and my husband, or I know better than me and my doctors, or I know better than I just know because I know it all. That's my pride talking. And so there was a whole litany of events that happened to me just in these very last couple years. It was kind of a culmination of really 30 years of this now coming to a close. And, you know, in the tables of Alcoholics Anonymous, they talk about jails, deaths, and institutions. Jails and institutions I certainly did experience, and I almost did experience death. So I was pretty close to the end there. And that was my easier, softer way, like the big book talks about. Examples of pride that were killing me were, you know, when I was in Meritor Psych Ward for the first time, telling a boardroom of doctors that I was discharging myself, because of course I knew more than, you know, 16 PhDs sitting in front of me. When I was in Oconomowoc Suicide Detox Center, I went to talk to the physician and insisted that I knew what medications I needed to be on at this point. It was just that insanity. And, you know, even just pride as a mother. I had three small children, and then I had three miscarriages. I just was not going to leave my post as a mother and a wife. That was my pride that was so built into that I became a monster in trying to rip me away from my family in order to get well. But I guess, like, the two biggest things where pride just about killed me is, number one, that I know what AA is. You know, I know all about AA. It's the higher power and God as you understand him. And, you know, I don't want to be a part of that group because, you know, I have already such a strong conception of God. I mean, Jesus is God. My very being and my ability to live and my ability to survive in this world is that Jesus is God, the Sacred Heart. And so the second thing about pride would be, not only do I know what AA is, I know who God is. And Jesus is God, and so I would be making the assumption that I know everything about God, and I really don't recommend putting limits on God. That would be making the assumption that I know how God is revealing himself to each one of you, and God being almighty and all-powerful and divine can reveal himself however he wants, to whomever he wants. And so I don't really recommend placing limits on God. And so let me take you to February 1st of last year, 2012. I had a kidney removed because of my, towards the end there, I was on such a large dose of several different kinds of prescription medications, and they were all being abused in order to, well, I suppose, survive. In the place I was towards the end there. And so when I went in, they gave me a mask when I was getting ready for my surgery and asked me to you know, think of a place I wanted to go, you know, the Bahamas or what have you. And I said Nazareth because I pretty much thought that was it. I pretty much thought I wasn't going to come out of that surgery. And I was already in a place of complete abandonment where I just was like, I just don't even know what to do anymore. My choices are going to AA and I can use a doorknob as my higher power, or giving up Jesus as God And so I decided that, you know, I was just going to die as a witness to the faith, as a martyr, because I was unable to give up that conception as Jesus as being God. And so what happened a week later on February 8th of 2012 was that I was talking belligerently to my husband in front of my three small children, and I ended up attacking him in front of my three small children in our farm, and I hurt him, and I violated him, and I violated my children, and I was thrown in jail. And a week out of major surgery with no medication. And I died, spiritually. My body still lived, of course, but I went through a spiritual crucifixion. And I got out, and I went to my mother's in Verona now for the second time in 10 years. First when my dad died, and now the second time. And I wandered around in the desert for a few months because I was addicted to oxycodone and morphine from my surgery. So I was kind of in between a rock and a hard place. I finally just thought to myself, I am just so sick. I am a really, really sick person right now. I'm physically sick, I'm mentally sick, I'm emotionally sick, I'm spiritually sick. I'm just, my entire existence is just very, very sick right now. And I'm separated from my family, who I love with all my heart. And so, if you look at this chart right here, my kids the other day were making little trick-or-treating maps. And each one, all three of them, had a different map. They had Grandma's house and the church, and then like different houses and places. Each one looked different, but they each had two important things. And so, I mean, this is just my map. Everybody has their own map. So at that point, my life was unmanageable. Not only was I not able to, in step one it says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol or drugs and that our lives had become unmanageable. Not only was I powerless over that, I was powerless over my friends, my family, people, places, situations, my resentments, my sadness, my anger, my bad choices, my past. I had all this that had been brewing in me for so long, and I had no way to express it. And it was unmanageable, and I was powerless. And even God, in that abstract view, where is Jesus? He's abstract, and he's kind of enveloped in my early PTSD, but in a good way. Not how I hear around the AA tables, you know, the fire and brimstone, and not just the Catholic Church, but in the Lutheran Church or the Methodist Church. That was the World War II era of this scary God. And so my ego drives me to manage things harder, and my pride fools me into thinking that I can manage my world. And so it was killing me. The moment of grace came when that pride and willfulness turned into willingness and humility. And that came when I was about ready to discharge myself from Gateway. You know, I had been taking the medications and abusing them for my kidney surgery. And of course I'm entitled to those because I had cancer. You know, I was so good at manipulating. You know, my father drowned. So I'm entitled to these things. And I'm special in that way. And I deserve it. And, you know, so I had to really get honest with myself as why I wanted these things when I went through recovery. And I was sitting in my Gateway counselor's office, and I had no kidney, and I have no family, and I'm about ready to discharge myself. And I remember saying to myself, Jesus, if you are God, help me. And it was in the asking. And that's when I got the intuitive thought, a really strong one, divine inspiration to not discharge myself, to accept that grace being offered, and I got to AA the very next day. And at that point is when I was ready to accept some help. And humility is the antidote of pride, the willingness. Wikipedia, humility, a quality by which a person considering his own defects has a humble opinion of himself and willingly submits himself to God and to others for God's sake. St. Bernard, a virtue by which a man knowing himself as he truly is, abases himself. Jesus Christ is the ultimate definition of humility. And so once I had asked, here I had been proclaiming, Jesus is God, Jesus is God. I've been adoring him. I've been loving him. I've been seeing his mercy. But my addiction takes my humility away. The only time I had it was that one time after my dad died, and I said, give me a purpose, whatever that is. And so I was able to follow directions and stop going down the crappy trail and start turning up towards the happy trail. It's the conversion towards Jesus in the asking, Jesus becoming not an abstract, but a real living God. And so I set up my camp. Who's in my camp to help me go up the happy trail? I have a priest. I have two spiritual advisors. I have a third spiritual advisor who is also my sponsor. I belong to Gateway Recovery. I have an addictologist. I have the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a very good friend who is a homeschool mother, and another really good friend. These were the people that were in my camp to help me go in the right direction. And my sponsor, Bren, took me to page 30 in the big book, and she told me that the delusion that we can drink, or in my case, to take pills also, like other people, has to be smashed. And I remember thinking that was just a word that was, it just resonated with me. It struck me because it kind of meant that everything that I'd been doing in the past just kind of had to stop at this point, and I just needed to follow instructions. And another thing that she did was took me through steps 2 and 3, which would be came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And because I couldn't make that jump because Jesus is God, right? So Bren was my power greater than myself. And that allowed me to kind of set all my preconceived notions just off to the side for a moment so I could follow instructions. And then in step 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I decided, and it's how I did get into AA finally too, was I decided, well, I might as well just try it. I can just use Jesus as God. And that's also how I did, and so that was my God as I understand him, or how God has revealed himself to me. He might not have revealed himself to any of you that way, but he certainly revealed himself to me that way from a very young age. And so one of the things that my sponsor also recommended me to do, she asked me, why are you not going to church right now? And I said, well, I'm not really sure. I kind of been doing this program. And she's like, well, she very much encouraged me to continue doing what I was doing in my church, and so I started to go into daily mass. I saw myself sitting in St. Andrew's Church in Verona on the 7th row up on the left side, staring at this image called the Divine Mercy image. And this is, there's a little, on the next page, a little excerpt about Helena Kowalska, who was a Polish nun in the 1930s. This is actually how Jesus appeared to her and told her to paint this image according to the pattern that she sees and place underneath it, Jesus, I trust in you. So as I was doing my sponsor in step 2 being my higher power, and then she was asking me to give myself to God as I understand him in complete abandonment, I was looking at this image and and gaining complete trust in Jesus as God as I understand him. And I started to learn about Sister Faustina. And while I was on a pilgrimage up to Our Lady of Good Hope, I kind of near Green Bay, it's a healing site, and it's also where there have been Marian apparitions. I bought a book about St. Faustina and the Divine Mercy, and I spent the next 4 months staring at this image of the Divine Mercy and saying, Jesus, I trust in you no matter what, no matter if something good is happening or something bad is happening. I'm rooting my being in you. I trust in you. And I'll just read you an excerpt about the Divine Mercy. It says, completely trust in Jesus. Trust in Jesus is the essence of the message of mercy that Sister Faustina received. When we go to a public fountain, we can draw water from it as long as we have a vessel or a container of some kind to put the water in. If our vessel is small, we can only bring back a little water. If it's large, we can bring back a lot. And anyone with a vessel can draw water from the fountain. The water is there for us, and no one is excluded. All we need is a vessel. And so it is with God's mercy. In repeated revelations to St. Faustina, our Divine Savior makes it clear that the fountain is his heart, the water is his mercy, and the vessel is his trust. And this is what I was learning about and studying while I was doing steps 2 and 3 in Alcoholics Anonymous. At the same time, my sponsor was telling me to cease fighting everyone and everything, and it was stopping that and trusting here. And then I, my sponsor led me into doing the house cleaning. We launched into step 4. One thing I do want to mention is that in this second map, after I started depending in step 3, when the living God, as I know him, Jesus, I trust in you, the Divine Mercy, this is how my map changed. I came into the center. God is on the outside managing everything. In John 14, I have to check that too, it says, Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. And so I was able to give Jesus everything with complete abandon and complete trust. All my bad choices, my regrets, my PTSD, my wonder, my longing, my hopes, my dreams, my sadness, sorrows, healing, anger, frustration, just everything. Just give it all to him. And inside my circle now are, just like I said, setting up camp, doing the PTSD work, going to AA, having a sponsor, learning to live a better life, you know, working with the priest, doing the commandments, exercising, getting the Eucharist, going to confession, all these things that I was unable to do, that my addiction was taking from me. It was stealing it from me. It was taking that humility. And so in moving the addiction out of the equation, I can get the humility to be even able to give it to God. I can't give it to him if he's not available. And my addiction keeps me at arm's length. And I like how Father Barron describes how in Dante's descent to hell, the devil is in ice, and he's so self-absorbed and so self-centered that he doesn't even look up. And that's exactly describes my addiction. It has me. I can't see the light of anything because it has me. And so that's where the humility is. Anyways, launching into step 4, my sponsor, I had taken through the Big Book Way, where we talked about, you know, what my character defects were, and what my, she was excellent in telling me and helping me see what my part was, because I had a very my thinking was impaired. I had a very difficult time seeing that. And an old timer also took me, Scotty, through the Back to Basics Way. And what I love about this too is that it gave me a snapshot of my character defects. You know, I was able to list people, institutions, principles that I was angry, disturbed, annoyed, or upset with. You know, parents, ex-boss, police, etc. And then ask myself for each and every one, where had I been resentful? Where had I been fearful? Where had I been selfish and self-centered? Where had I been dishonest? Where had I been false pride? False pride meaning the feeling of feeling less than or greater than someone else. And I've suffered from that my entire life, from early childhood, always feeling less than everybody who had families who weren't afflicted with alcoholism. And when I was doing so well in my sales job, going to the top of nothing, I, of course, had false pride that I was better than everybody else. So that is just such a fallacy. Pride is just so deadly. And they say the greatest deadly sin. Jealousy or not trusting, envy. Where have I been lazy? Where have I been inconsiderate? Where have I been shameful or guilty? Well, anybody who I've been lying to about my drug addiction or my alcoholism, I had been dishonest to. And then everybody pretty much would be shame and guilt for that too. So I noticed a pattern that all the people that were closest to me in my life had the most checked. And then as I got out further, and I was thorough. I worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous like my salvation depended upon it, because I wasn't sure if I was going to get to go back home or not. So I wanted to be extremely thorough and extremely complete. And anyways, with regards to the house cleaning, once again, my sponsor referred me to page 74 in the big book that says, those of us belonging to a religious denomination, which requires confession, must, and of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty is to receive it. Though we have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by an established religion. We often find such a person quick to see and understand our problem. Of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand alcoholics. And so I did. I went ahead and I picked up an examination of conscience. So I examined myself with the big book for my sobriety, but I also wanted to be extremely thorough. And so I picked up an examination of conscience, and I did it according to the standards of the Catholic Church also, in the confessional. One of the reasons why we do this is, there's a couple reasons. Biblically, Father Vernon pointed out to me, in Matthew 16:18-20, he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. All that I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you lose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. Father Vernon also showed me John 20:19-23. On the evening of that day, the first of the week, the doors being shut were where the disciples were for fear of the Jews. Jesus came and stood among them and said to them, "Peace be with you." When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, even so I send you." And when he had said this, he breathed on them, and he said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained." And lastly, in the 2 Corinthians 5:17-21, Therefore, if any one is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has passed away. Behold, the new has come. All this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, in Christ God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. So we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us. We beg you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. For our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. And so I did take my back to basics sheet into the confessional, and I also continue to go into the confessional every Saturday to make sure that there are some, at times, resentments can seem to pop up. And Father Vernon says to just cast those resentments into the sea of God's infinite ocean of mercy and put up a no fishing sign. And I don't think you would mind me borrowing that, but it's true, because whenever I feel something kind of starting to pop up, I just have to say, I'm not fishing. I'm not even going there. I don't need to go there. And it just, I can just give it to Jesus along with everything else, and I can just tend to what I need to in a day's time, in a moment at a time, at a day at a time. And I was thinking, how can I explain to the people in AA why I do this in the confessional? And the only thing I can think of is a parable that I feel Jesus gave to me. And our family had lice a couple weeks ago. And, you know, I had to go to Walgreens and buy a bottle of shampoo to clean it out. And there were three steps on the bottle. The first one was to examine. The second one was to treat. And the third one was to remove the eggs with the nit comb. So it's almost like in AA we're doing that house cleaning and we're getting rid of all that stuff for our sobriety, but taking it even a step further into the confessional, and literally I've just got so sick and tired of, for the last 30 years, my addiction ruining every single good thing that ever came my way. I just ripped it right out from the roots and tore it out in the confessional. Another parable would be that our dog ate chicken thighs off the counter. And I took him to the veterinarian. And they asked me, or actually the vet took an x-ray to see what was inside. There was a sharp bone and a couple crunched bones. And the veterinarian gave me three choices. The first choice would be to do nothing and just let him pass. And it's the cheapest. It doesn't cost me a single thing. The second choice would be to put the dog under and put a scope down and pull out the sharp pieces. And it costs a little bit to me, but I get the big pieces out. And the third step was, which costs the most, to have him completely put under and have everything removed complete in full in completion. And so I kind of liken that to ripping it out by the roots, that last choice. It cost me the most in terms of humility. Oh, I have resentment against the Catholic Church. Oh, I need an annulment. I don't. That takes a lot of humility. And my sponsor, Bren, is the ultimate woman who demonstrated humility. It's a person who knows the big book. She knows the big book. She's cleaned house. She's helped hundreds of people clean house. And she lived. And she was going to die this time. And I suggested, because I had just done this, I suggested her to go to the confessional. She's not Catholic, but she said in her humility, her ultimate humility, I will seek God wherever I can find him. And she went in, and she talked with Father Vernon, and she did that work. And there is something different. There is an invisible healing that takes place that is different from just the cleaning house in the AA. There's a healing, like St. John the Baptist in Touching the Relics. There's a healing. For some reason, I'm supposed to be telling you about it. So anyways, let's launch into step 9. Well, actually, I do want to mention, so step 4 is that making that searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, which is that, examining the conscience and in the back to basics way, where have I been resentful. And then if I'm doing 5, 6, and 7, and all these are really steps of humility, I mean, if I'm in the confessional, I'm already admitting to God, and I'm ready, and I'm asking him to, I don't even have to ask. They're just forgiven. I'm absolved of my sins already. just like I read to you, you know, the gospel, the biblical reasons from Matthew 16 and John 20. Jesus gave his apostles, and now through all these millions, thousands of years later, through the priest to forgive those sins. So I don't even have to ask. I just need to have a little humility to go there, and they're forgiven automatically. So I kind of clumped steps 5, 6, and 7 all together. With step 8, making a list of all the people I had harmed, I already had that list made from the Back to Basics sheet. And then when I launched into step 9 and making direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to injure them, except when to do so would injure them or others, when I got to this point, I had ripped everything out by the roots. I was sick and tired of this addiction ruining my life and just about taking it. And so, you know, now there's a lot of wreckage, and so it's going around and fixing a little bit of that. And it takes actually a long, 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 long time to. I'm still in trying to fix it right now, and it's been a couple years now. And so it's not something that just is fixed right away. And so at least a start is the people that were closest to me that I hurt, like my husband and my children and my mother-in-law and my mother, I was able to go forward and tell them that my sponsor said not I was sorry, because they've heard that 1,000 times, but I was wrong. And an example of a relationship that was really restored after 35 years of resentment was the one with my mother, because, you know, I always did blame her for not keeping me in that first communion lifestyle. You know, it really wasn't her fault. My dad got sick with alcoholism, but that was the ideal, and anything falling less than that was just not okay with me. And so when I found myself imprisoned with her in a hostile environment for 190 days or a little less than that, there was lots of disturbances. And Bren, just my sponsor, just she took my hand and she taught me how to deal with those disruptions in my life. And that you know, whenever I was self-pitying myself, to set my alarm clock for 15 minutes and to stop it, and then to get into a solution and serve her, do something for her. And all these years, you know, the people served me. So, you know, whenever there was some major disturbances, she would just tell me to just go excuse yourself. Go somewhere quiet, calm the disturbance, and ask God for an intuitive thought, intuitive feeling, or an inspiration. And it's right there in the big book. And so I got really good at practicing those, because there was a lot of disturbances. So, and I used those skills, those basic skills that she taught me. They're just, I can't thank her enough. They're so fantastic. And so I'd like to just read the amends that I wrote to my mother. Like I said, the relationship was really broken. You know, I had a difficult time figuring out what my part was in this, because I was just a kid. And my sponsor told me, you know, your part was that when you turned to be an adult, you didn't get help for yourself. And I should have. I was an addict at age 13. From the time I took my first drug. But, so that was my part in that, and there was some other things. So, it's, Mom, I have harmed you and our entire family through my behaviors and actions and addiction. I just simply will not be able to get over my addiction until I do my utmost to straighten out the past. Over the years, during the course of my addictions to alcohol and pills, and perhaps even during my sobriety, I was resentful, selfish, self-centered, harbored false pride, dishonest, lazy, and inconsiderate. For example, I have been resentful towards you for many years for things that were a result of life circumstance. I failed to get help for myself to deal with these resentments, and I let them pile up. I alienated you from my emotional life, and not only that, from my life in general for many years. I did not call you or even talk to you for a long, long time on a regular basis. But then when I would call or see you, it would be in a selfish nature where I would be trying to get something I wanted or not losing something I had. For example, barely talking to you when you lived in Minnesota after Ron, but then when I wanted a down payment for my big house, I was quick to call you. Also, by removing you from my life, I was not treating you like my mother, which is your God-given right, let alone another human being. Another example would be not caring about you and your life and what you happen to be going through, but only with myself. Is my mother going to walk my dog? Is she going to watch my kids, help me with my housework, etc.? And then when you wouldn't comply to all my needs, I would become angry and resentful again. I have also harbored false pride towards you. In other words, I have always thought I was better than you. I thought I had better morals, had better intelligence, was smarter, wiser, nicer, better clothes, better style, and the list goes on. The truth of the matter is that I have been so judgmental about your humanness and the mistakes I believe that you have made. I have made the exact same mistakes. Here I have been holding you to a higher standard than myself, which was very arrogant and definitely a sense of false pride. I have been very lazy and have not done chores and deeds from the very earliest memory. I was not obedient or respectful towards you as a parent. I was certainly not honoring you or your wishes. I have also been very dishonest for a very long time about how sick I actually was. I concealed from you how much I was drinking from age 14 on up and about how many pills I was taking from age 32 on up. You never really knew how sick I was, which is the common denominator in all of my life's faults and failings, being suspended from high school, moving countless times, failed relationships, friendships, marriages, alienating family members, rude behavior, lost jobs, onset of other illnesses, and poor health, migraine, smoking, anxiety, panic, etc. Separation from your grandkids up until present. I have been inconsiderate towards you in your own home. I have expected you to set the thermostat at what I think it should be or allow me to watch TV or not giving you enough privacy, which I'm still working on, or throwing dog poop on your driveway or threatening you or acting scary not too long ago or criticizing your drinking in your own home, not allowing you peace in your own home. Lastly, you have taken me into your own home twice in the last 10 years. In 2004, after Dad's death, and in 2012, after my husband had to take drastic action in order to save my life. Given all of this, you still took me in and are still helping me, despite how poorly I have treated you all these years, and I am so very thankful. Mom, I truly and deeply regret any and all harm or pain I have caused you. I was wrong. In an effort that this will never occur again between us or anyone else, I am seeking outpatient rehabilitation through Gateway, in which I see a therapist and a psychiatrist specializing in addiction. I'm also in Alcoholics Anonymous, a 12-step program, and work very closely with a sponsor. I've been attending one or more AA meetings every day since April 14, 2012, and have detoxed off all potentially harmful and addictive prescription and non-prescription medications. A friend helps me monitor my other prescription medications daily, and I am set to start DBT in August, which is Dialectical Behavioral Therapy, an 8-month program which teaches stress reduction management, mindfulness meditation, behavioral therapy, and other life coping skills without the use of substances. I have also been seeking counsel from my priest, Father Vernon, and have 2 spiritual advisors available to me. Is there anything I have missed, any other harms I have caused you, or any way I can further rectify things between us? With great respect and adoration, love, your daughter, Jean. And after I wrote this amends, I emailed it to my sponsor, and she read it over and emailed it back to me with the approval to go ahead. I printed it out, and I sat down very serious, because when I did amends, I know people say, you know, it's for my program, I'm doing it for myself, but when I did it, I mean, I was really, really sorry that I had hurt so many people after all these years, and after I had been sitting in front of that divine mercy image, Jesus showing me that every single indiscretion, every single lie, every single manipulation, every single thing was a scourge mark on him. And I decided that I was going to make amends to Jesus, and that in atonement for the first half of my life, I was going to spend the second half of my life doing work for him. And so, after I read this to my mother, she said I had wondered what was wrong with you all these years. She didn't know what had been wrong with me because I was so good at lying and hiding and excluding and being isolated. And so the relationship was restored. And today we have it's not perfect. You know, my kids were playing the other day on the floor, and my daughter messed up my other daughter's Slinky, all mixed up, and brought it to me, and I had to unwind that thing. And it took time, and it came back together, but it just wasn't quite perfect. And I think that's kind of I don't want to make assumptions on God, but it feels like that's maybe kind of what he has to do for me. I mess everything up, like the Slinky all mixed up, and he's got to, like, take all this time. It has to be in his time to put it back together. And it might not be exactly the way it was before, but it's darn close. And launching into step 10, continue to take personal inventory. And I also, with regards to step 9, I left an example that my sponsor emailed me on how to make a good amends. It's just the format, which I just inserted my own information. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. For me, I like to call step 10 the choice discourse. At the end of the day, I look at my choices that I made during the day. I have a choice in every single moment between good and bad. I know taking a drug or a drink for me is a bad choice. So then what it becomes is, what is a good choice, and, you know, how to make a choice between good and a better choice. And so that gets a little bit tricky. Always having that humility of, God, please direct me. What would you have me choose? And for myself, what I do is, the litmus test for me in between good and a better choice is, which choice glorifies God? If it's the good choice that is going to glorify God more than maybe the better choice, which is maybe my pride, then I'll just choose the good choice. That I have to exercise the virtue of prudence also, because my pride once again can say, I know this is the best choice. I know it. But I could be stumbling up someone else's faith journey also, or somebody else's journey. And so to be mindful of that, I might just need to make just that good choice for today, and not insist on the better choice that I think, in my opinion, is the best choice. And also, so I asked myself that at the end of the day, how did I do? I have one shot at today. I only got one chance, and then it's folded into eternity for the rest of history. I have one chance, so I know not to pick up a drink or a drug. That's a bad choice. And then discerning between the good and the better choices, asking God for help, glorifying God always. But then I said, how did I lament in God's garden today? Did I praise him? Did I thank him? Did I write about him? Did I sing about him? Did I do something for him? And they just had a reading on the gospel the other day about, are you a Martha or a Mary? And Mary was the disciple who sat at Jesus' feet and listened to him. And Martha was the one who was doing things for Jesus. She even said, Jesus, tell Mary to help me. She was telling God what to do. So Jesus says the better choice is to actually be Mary. It's who we are for God instead of what we're doing for God. And I love that. And so I just totally stole that from Father Vernon's homily the other day. So so step 10 for me is all about the choices discourse. And then step 11 is thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. St. Therese calls prayer a surge of the heart, and I love that because it's just taking all the love that I have and just sending it straight up to God. And it could be asking for help, it could be begging, it could be thanking. Last year on Mother's Day, when I was separated from my family, I went over. I couldn't see my three children that day. So I went over to the graves of my three deceased children that I lost in 2008, 2009, and 2010. And I remember from my first communion days that the rosary was Mary's invitation to contemplate the life of her son through a series of 20 gospel meditations. And I included a couple of them here in the packet, but you can Google it. And I did that prayer every day, and I did it every day for 4 months, more than once. And for instance, the agony in the garden, you know, being away from my family felt like the agony in the garden, how Jesus is praying to God, you know, are you sure you really want me to die for you? You know, sweating blood and tears. I wasn't quite that, you know, but it was so much agony being separated from my children. And each of those 20 mysteries has a fruit that goes with it. And the fruit of that mystery is God's will be done. And so, once again, Jesus, I trust in you, in steps 2 and 3 in the Divine Mercy from St. Faustina, and something more powerful than my small mind can understand, that I am going through this right now in on Mother's Day, away from my family. God's will be done. And also, another example would be, and that's the first sorrowful mystery. The first joyful mystery is when the angel Gabriel announces to Mary, she's going to be the mother of God. We were just talking about this in our homeschool book group the other day, that Mary didn't say, you know, I don't think so. I'm going to go down to Jerusalem for a while. She said, let it be done according to your will. And that is ultimate humility, not knowing why. And I felt like I was in the desert for so long, going through, ripping out drug after drug after drug, ripping everything out in the confessional, cleaning house, taking out the chemicals. I don't want to mince words. I think alcohol and drugs is the devil, prowling around on the earth trying to ruin souls. And so if you Google rosary as a weapon, it can stomp on the head of the devil, contemplating the life of Jesus. And that's exactly what I did. Step 12 is having had a spiritual awakening. I would call it more of like a spiritual smack upside the head. as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. You know, for me, I am happy to teach everybody what my sponsor told me in terms of abstaining from alcohol and drugs, but I almost feel like I'm responsible now to share this message also to alcoholics, to Muslims, to Baptists, to Methodists, to non-practicing, to anybody in whatever fashion or form. And I mean, I for step 12, I'm a walking miracle. I mean, I have one kidney. I don't have any more cancer. I was sent on my way, no chemo. I was cured of a life-threatening addiction. I don't have any mental illness. I don't have any depression. I'm not on any medications. I was saved by God's grace. I had to accept it. And my works that I do are an expression of my faith. It feels like now for me, God is telling me to, by the way, I live back in Orchard Ridge where I started out. It feels like God is saying he's redeeming the time I lost that was taken from me. And he's saying, repeat that pattern. So rather than being in a drinking party, I am in the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration as a prayer advocate. That's my sorority. I'd like to go back to school and get a degree in sacred theology rather than biology, which I didn't really have any interest in. And I'm not sure really what the product is I'm selling, maybe to share the message of the Divine Mercy. I kind of feel like I'm supposed to be the first woman Jesuit, but then that's an interesting thought, actually. All for God's greater glory. I don't want to put limits on God. I've done that. I don't want to do it. So I don't really know what the pinnacle is of that. Heaven? I don't know. Death? I don't know. So anyways, if your life has been absolutely torn apart by death, You know, I've had miscarriages that probably were caused by my addiction. You know, my father drowned because of addiction. You know, my addiction took all that from me. There's healing. There's a bereavement ministry. There's help if your marriage has been drugged through the mud. I mean, my husband and I have been married 7 years, and, you know, we had our son and our twins and lost three, and then cancer, and then, you know, an addiction, and it's like we just keep on keeping on. There's Rachel's project, if you need abortion after healing. I mean, all the records that occur, you know, we sober up in AA, but then what? There's got to be some invisible healing there. And the only place that I know where that can occur is through Jesus and his church. So Retrovi, help and healing. If you have resentments against the Catholic Church, there's a Calyx group that meets the third Sunday of every month down at St. Mary's, and it incorporates the 12 steps and sacraments and mass and breakfast, and it's a good place to kind of air that stuff out. And I'd just like to invite everybody here to, like Father Vernon tells me, to invite everybody you know to meet Jesus Christ in a new and life-changing way. Just invite him to Mass. It's not what I hear around the tables. It's not the fire and brimstone, the scary God. God is love. God is love. Peace and joy. It's not what it used to be. And so I know that because I'm there every day. At the end of all of this, there was a huge rainbow in the sky. And I really did feel like it was my rainbow. Whether or not it was, that was on the day I got to go home after I had ripped all those alcohol and drugs out of my body. I conquered myself for the love of Jesus Christ. And I stood alone as just a soul with God, with no attachment, no mother, no wife, no nothing, just a soul. And that's a very interesting perspective to have. Now, very lastly, I just want to read, and this is a quick excerpt out of a book called The Story of a Soul, the autobiography of St. Therese. It's a spiritual classic. She's a doctor of the church. And she was a French nun in the 1930s, so not very long ago. She says, "For a long time I had wondered why God had preferences, why he did not give the same degree of grace to everyone. I was rather surprised that he should pour out such extraordinary graces on great sinners like St. Paul, St. Augustine, and so many others, forcing his grace on them, so to speak. I was rather surprised, too, when reading the lives of the saints, to find our Lord treating certain privileged souls with the greatest tenderness from cradle to the grave, removing all obstacles from their upward path to him, and preserving the radiance of their baptismal robe from the stains of sin. Also, I wondered why so many poor savages die without ever hearing our Lord's name. Jesus chose to enlighten me on this mystery. He opened the book of nature before me, and I saw that every flower he has created has a beauty of its own, that the splendor of the rose and the lily's whiteness do not deprive the violet of its scent, nor make less ravishing the daisy's charm. I saw that if every little flower wished to be a rose, nature would lose her spring adornment, and the fields would be no longer enameled with their varied flowers. So it is in the world of souls, the living garden of the Lord. It pleases him to create great saints who may be compared with the lilies or the rose. But he has also created little ones who must be content to be daisies or violets nestling at his feet to delight his eyes when he so should choose to look upon them. The happier they are to be as he wills, the more perfect they are." And so back in April, I said, "Jesus, what flower am I in your garden? If it be your will, by the next flower that I receive, let that be an indication of the flower that I am in your garden." And I did receive a flower from my daughter Olivia, and it was a dandelion. And I thought, I'm a weed! You know, honestly, I'm happy just to be a flower, period, and not be, like, wilted up and dead on the ground. And so my husband and I were in the Retrovive retreat last weekend, tending to our marriage. And in one of the dialogue questions that we had to answer was, why do you want to go on living? And this is the response I wrote to him. I want to go on living because Jesus has shown unto me that I am his little dandelion in his book of nature, according to St. Therese. A dandelion is one of God's hardiest wildflowers. By the way, I did pick up a book on dandelions, and this is what it said about dandelions. It is the very first book and sentence in the book was, dandelions are survivors. And a dandelion is one of God's hardiest wildflowers, a survivor, a fighter. It even grows up through the crack of a cement street, and God can stoop down to look at it if he so chooses. I want to go on living because I am precious and loved and admired by God. As his little dandelion, I can be at his service in any way he so chooses. Just as in the Annunciation, where the angel Gabriel announces to Mary that she is to be the mother of God, Mary's fiat was, let it be done according to your will. And so it is with this soul, who was fighting even before she was born, and when my own mother chose to say yes to God and have me. I want to go on living because even if no one else thinks I'm of any value, God does. God thinks I'm worth something. He loves me. I want to do his will, and his will for me today is to be your wife, a children's mother, a daughter, a friend, a servant, and a neighbor. And I am at his service to do great things for him.